Hello and welcome to the class. This is a Christian Apologetics Methods course with Dr. Robert Bowman. This class is made possible by the Theology Program of Reclaiming the Mind Ministries. Visit the Theology Program's homepage at www.thetheologyprogram.com. Thanks and enjoy the session.
We are continuing this series of classes or meetings where we're talking about Christian apologetics methods as part of the theology program, an elective for the theology program of Reclaiming the Mind Ministries. And we have already given kind of a brief introduction to the subject of apologetic methods and looked at the variety of apologetics called classical apologetics. And this evening we're going to begin our discussion of evidential apologetics. Now, evidentialism is one of the most popular approaches to Christian apologetics today. It enjoys widespread support among American evangelical Christians as well as evangelical conservative Christians in other countries as well, but I would say that it historically has been an approach to apologetics that has been especially influential in English-speaking countries. And there's a reason for that, which we'll get into, I think, a little bit, or at least touch upon. But evidentialism really can be understood most easily by comparing and contrasting it with classical apologetics. So without spending too much time on this, in fact, just a very, very short time indeed, I hope, let me remind you of what we said before about classical apologetics and at its core, in its essence, what classical apologetics tries to do, the way it tries to present the case for Christianity. Classical apologetics gives priority to or emphasis on deductive reasoning, deductive logic, as the critical tool to be used as much as possible in presenting as close to an ironclad case for Christianity as one can put together rationally. The ideal argument for a classical apologist is one which reasons from one or at most a very few premises, basic assumptions or starting points of an argument called premises, and to the conclusion. And the premises ideally are statements that propositions that are beyond dispute or as close to being beyond dispute as possible. So again, the ideal argument for a classical apologist is to start with as non-controversial a starting point as possible, as few statements or assertions as possible, which are hopefully going to be accepted by everybody or nearly everybody. And then simply by reasoning logically from those initial starting points, those initial observations or generalizations or assertions of fact, if necessary, but as few as possible, as non-controversial as possible, the goal is to find a path deductively as much as possible, logically, to the conclusion that you're trying to reach. Now, the standard example of a classical apologist today would be Norman Geisler, who, of course, is someone who identifies himself as a classical apologist and has argued vigorously for this approach. And Geisler maintains that a sound Christian apologetic, though it will give a priority, to be sure, to deductive reason, cannot use deductive logic alone, Because Geisler identifies two steps or two stages to the complete apologetic. Stage one is the defense of theism, T-H-E-I-S-M, theism, the belief in God, the belief, the worldview which says there is a God who created the world out of nothing and who is capable of intervening in the world miraculously. According to Norman Geisler, this conclusion that God exists can be attained logically through a deductive argument which is logically tight and really unassailable as long as you give him one premise, which is that something rather than nothing exists. And the goal is then to reason from the existence of something to the conclusion that God exists. Well, you know, it's hard to dispute that something exists. We're here to talk about it. What that something might be would be a matter of argument, perhaps. But you know, generally speaking, people agree that there is a world, we happen to live in it, and it's real, something exists. Well, Geisler's argument then, having established rationally that the world is not self-explanatory and that there must be a God who made it, that theism is true, then Geisler wishes to argue inductively or empirically in a evidential manner, looking at the evidences for Christianity once one has established, though, the existence of God. So, to put it very simply, Geisler's approach is you first prove that God exists rationally. So there's really no room for doubt. There's no room for debate, even, as far as Geisler is concerned. I mean, people will debate it, but there is a rational argument that leads to the certain conclusion that God exists. But then, having established that theism is true, which you can then leave out Hinduism and Buddhism and a lot of other isms that don't acknowledge the theistic God, Geisler will argue, based on the evidence, that the true form of theism is found in the religion of Christianity and that the evidence supports that, such as the evidence for fulfilled prophecy and the miracles of Jesus, his resurrection, and so forth. Now, that's the classical approach in a nutshell, this 1-2 punch of first proof theism, then argue on the basis of the evidence for Christian theism as the true religious conclusion. How does evidentialism differ from this? Well, evidentialism differs from this in that it rolls up stage one and stage two of the classical argument into one more complex argument, an argument of a different sort. Rather than arguing first that God exists and then looking at evidence for Christianity, the evidentialist has a one-step argument, which is, let's look at all the evidence from every quarter. We'll look at the evidence from science and from history, perhaps psychology, the evidence from anthropology, and aesthetics, the evidence from any quarter that you like, and we'll include the evidence from philosophy, the art, you know, we'll look at philosophical arguments, and we'll pull all these things together according to the evidentialist. We'll look at all the evidence, and then we will show, conclude based on all the evidence, that the most reasonable conclusion is that Christianity is true. So the purpose here again is assumes, which everybody who is interested in apologetics from a Christian's perspective agrees, that we want to try to present the best case for Christianity. We want to present Christianity as truth in a way that is most potent, most cogent, most persuasive. And the classical apologist thinks that his way is the best way of doing it, this 1-2 punch, first theism, then Christianity. The evidentialist says, no, this is a better approach. We're going to look at all the evidence for Christianity, including the evidence for God, the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, the evidence of fulfilled prophecy, and we'll look at different kinds of evidences for God, some of which are going to prove some things about God, some of which are going to prove other things about God, or at least point in that direction. And all these evidences will cumulatively, is the way some evidentialists put it, lead to the conclusion that, hey, it looks like Christianity is true. All right, so the style or form of argument here is very different. Again, classical apologists want to start with as few premises as possible, and then reason from, and hopefully indisputable premises, and then reason from these few premises, one if you can do it, to the conclusion that God exists. The evidentialist wants to proceed from as many facts as possible, as much evidence as you can get, from all quarters. Bring it on. Bring everything to the table that you can find. Amass the evidence, and then put together a case for Christianity based on all of this evidence. Now, these are very different forms of argument. What has happened here? Why have some apologists abandoned the simpler sounding, or at least for some people's money, simpler approach of start with as few premises as possible and try to find some way of drawing a nice, clean, straight line from this premise or these two or three premises to the conclusion you want? Why have they abandoned that for this sounds messier anyway, or form of argument where you try to pull together all kinds of facts from history and science and whatever, and you try to pull them together in such a way that you make a case for your conclusion? Why is this why this difference? Well, the answer is because we live in a different intellectual world than we did 1,000 years ago. Or even 500 years ago. And what happened really is something that everyone here hopefully knows something about. In fact, I would venture to say everyone here does know something about it. But it's something that we need to spend a lot of time thinking about if we're really going to understand what's going on here in a thorough way. What happened is, in short, in a word, the development of modern science. Now, if I could back up here just so that you understand what happened here. Medieval science and medieval philosophy are almost indistinguishable. In medieval thought, science and philosophy are two different ways of talking about the same thing, which is the pursuit of knowledge, the pursuit of understanding of the world that we live in. And deductive reasoning is the primary means of gaining knowledge in philosophy, and mathematical reasoning is the primary means of gaining information in science. And you really could almost reverse those, flip those around, and still get the same answer. Mathematics is a kind of deductive reasoning. At least the standard kind of approaches that people took to mathematics until very recently was your goal here is to reach an absolutely certain conclusion, the right answer. In math, there is one answer. It is the right answer. No other answer is possible if you work the equations properly, or if you perform your geometrical analysis correctly. You will reach the one and only possible conclusion that is absolutely certain. It cannot be anything else. If the answer is 4, it cannot be 4.2. It can't be 5. It can't be 10. People that want certainty like math, because, at least until very recently it seemed, mathematics provided a testable, trackable, reproducible way of attaining certainty. And medieval science was based primarily on mathematics and only secondarily on observation. We saw the heavenly bodies up in the sky. We watched them. And then we would come up with certain guesses or intuitions that were really based on a kind of reasoning rather than purely observation as to what was going on in the heavenly bodies, what they were doing. And based on certain assumptions about the nature of mathematical reality in the Greek mind, the assumption was made that all heavenly bodies moved in perfect circles. And so the problem was there are these pesky objects moving in the sky that don't move in perfect circles as we observe them. They seem to wander, and these are known as planets. Planet basically means a wanderer. Well, the Greek scientists were really Greek mathematicians trying to develop a mathematical model for describing the motions of all heavenly bodies in terms of perfect circles. The observations were secondary. It was the math that was crucial. Well, I realize you may wonder what this all has to do with apologetics, but the punchline is potent. Along comes a fellow named Copernicus. Copernicus was a Polish priest in the late 15th century. This is before the Reformation, when he's working on this, and shortly before. Really in the dawning of the Reformation era. Copernicus is working on this question of the motions of the heavenly bodies. And the Greek mathematical assumptions were getting harder and harder to correlate with the observations they actually had, because some people were watching these things, and it was getting more and more complicated. And Copernicus came up with an alternate suggestion, which is maybe we have been making a faulty assumption here that all of the heavenly bodies are moving around the earth. Maybe at least some of the heavenly bodies are moving around the sun. Well, that was an assumption that was just not in keeping with Greek science, with the assumptions of Greek science. And of course it seemed in some people's minds to conflict with the Bible as well, which is another story. Well, eventually people had to admit that Copernicus was right, but when his book was published after he died, they wouldn't publish it till after he passed away. There was a preface added to the book that basically said, if this sounds heretical, don't worry about it. Think of it as simply a way to explain, to do the math in a much easier way. You know, don't take this literally that the heavenly bodies revolve around the sun rather than the earth. Just think of it as an easy way to do the math. Well, eventually, of course, people understood that it wasn't simply an easier way to do the math, that it was a better way to explain what they were actually seeing, and Galileo was the person who really tipped the scales on that. But the real person I want you to hear about here isn't Copernicus or Galileo, as important as they were. It was Kepler, because Kepler broke through the Greek assumption that everything had to move in the heavenly bodies in perfect circles. He said, maybe the earth is moving around the sun not in a perfect circle but in an ellipse. And maybe some of these other heavenly bodies are also moving around the sun in ellipses. Well, that just wasn't done. It was crude. It was inelegant. It was not considered a good form, if you will. But turns out that was right. The observations that Kepler and others were making using the telescope, inspired by Galileo's example, forced them to abandon their assumptions of perfect circles for something a little bit messier, which was an ellipse. And eventually they had to admit that it wasn't even a perfect ellipse, because there were other things going on that perturbed the ellipse, that disturbed it, disturbed the planet from moving in its perfect ellipse. We know this now as gravity, as heavenly bodies and the Earth included, exerting gravitational forces on each other. Isaac Newton was the person who came up with that understanding. Now, why is all this important? Because as people in the Western world began to come to terms with these radical changes in their way of looking at the world, and their way of even thinking about how you decide if something is true or not, what they found themselves doing, and it took 200 or 300 years for this to happen, was they began thinking about things in terms of, let's look at as many facts as we can, get as much observation as we can, make more powerful telescopes, take more readings, more measurements, gather as much information as we can before we reach a conclusion. Now, see, this is just not the typical medieval way of thinking about truth anymore. Now we're trying to gather as much information as we can and then reach conclusions based on that information. The problem is, when you do that, you have some information that doesn't line up perfectly, neatly, with your explanation of the phenomena. And this is what science... this was perhaps the most radical thing about modern science. It wasn't that it was, quote-unquote, heretical to some people's way of thinking. It wasn't that it disturbed certain pet theories that the church had accepted from Greek science without critically examining it and mistakenly assuming it was taught in the Bible. Those were the most radical dimensions of it. Arguably, the most radical thing about modern science was that it threw a lot of matters into a realm of uncertainty. We are not really sure we're anymore about some things. We're not absolutely, we can't prove absolutely, with absolute certainty, everything that we are finding out as we make these observations and try to correlate them together in some way. This is what is radically disturbing to many people's minds about modern science, is that it seems to lead to uncertainty. Ironically, as modern science has gained increasingly more and more information about the world, as we've learned more and more about the world that we live in physically, as we've seen things that we never could see before, as we've come to some kind of understanding of things that we couldn't understand before, we've also found ourselves less certain than we used to be of what we are seeing. Things are not as absolutely clear or absolutely definitively provable when you are basing your conclusions on masses of information, some of which may be more accurately observed and more accurately recorded than other pieces of information. If you want to see this delightfully voiced or articulated in a kind of an offbeat context, take a look sometime at the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical film, The King and I. In The King and I, the King of Siam, played by Yul Brynner in the movie, sings a song in which he complains that when he was a boy, what was so, and what was not. But now that he's a man, he's finding out that that's not always the way it is. He says, some things nearly so, some things nearly not. And what he's experiencing is not just adulthood, which of course, that's part of it, but he's also experiencing the shock of modern Western knowledge, modern Western science. where some things are nearly so and other things nearly not, where we're not always absolutely sure of what we know. Now, there are Christian apologists who have embraced this, who have said, yes, we do not have absolutely perfect knowledge of the world we live in. Some things we know pretty confidently, some things we know less confidently, some things we aren't really sure of at all, some things we're just guessing. And these apologists who have embraced this wholeheartedly, and who have sought to develop a defense of the Christian faith that embraces this understanding of knowledge in the modern world, are called evidentialists. Okay? If I could put it to you that way. So it's sort of a cultural, historical perspective on evidentialism. The evidentialist says the modern scientist is right. We do not have absolute certain knowledge of the world we live in. We don't have absolute certain knowledge of the motion of the heavenly bodies. We don't have absolutely certain knowledge of the events of the past, that is, history. But we can arrive at good conclusions about these things through a patient investigation of as much of the evidence as we can amass. And so the evidentialist embraces the uncertainty of modern knowledge, accepts it for what it is, and says, you know, there are some things we just can't be absolutely sure of, but there are some things that we can have really good reasons to accept. And we can develop arguments for the truth of Christianity that respect these limitations of human knowledge, that reach conclusions that are only probable or can only be shown to be probably true based on the arguments that we're using. But they are, if they are more probable than not, then we still are intellectually justified in concluding that they are reasonable conclusions, that these are reasonable understandings of the way things are. And we can commend these conclusions to other people using these types of arguments. Now, if you want to know who is the first Christian apologist who thinks this way, there are various individuals that might be mentioned, but I think the fellow that we're going to have to point to who first brings this way of thinking to a conscious level and states things in this kind of way is Joseph Butler. Joseph Butler wrote a book in 1736 called The Analogy of Religion. I'm kind of curious, and how many of you, and this would be before you, if you've read Faith Has Its Reasons, before you looked at Faith Has Its Reasons. So how many of you, apart from having read my book, Faith Has Its Reasons, have ever heard of Joseph Butler's book, The Analogy of Religion? I'm just curious if maybe you could kind of give a one if you, or a yes if you, if you've heard of that. I'm guessing, yeah, never heard of Joseph Butler. I'm guessing that most of you have never heard of Joseph Butler. This book that he wrote in 1736 was, even into the 20th century, required reading in many universities in the Western world, especially into the 19th, middle of the 19th century, but even to some, in some places in the early 20th century. This was required reading. And it was an extremely influential defense of Christianity. Perhaps one of the, 20 or 30 most influential books of apologetics ever written. Maybe one of the top 10. Very influential. Now, what Butler did in The Analogy of Religion. Butler was a British Christian, and what he attempted to do was to develop an argument for Christianity that was based on fact and not on philosophical reasoning. You know, a butler named Joseph. Yeah. And what he does in this book is he attempts to present a positive case for Christianity, drawing on a variety of arguments and evidences, and admitting that his arguments do not provide absolute proof. And in the course of presenting this argument, he makes a statement, in fact, right at the very beginning of the book, he makes a statement that typifies the evidentialist shift in its view of knowledge, its view of reasoning, its view of how we go about deciding if we're going to believe something. He says at the very beginning of the book that probability is the very guide of life. Let me repeat that. He says probability is the very guide of life. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, the way this is often illustrated is that when you make decisions in life, they are almost always, if not always, based on assessments, conclusions that you reach in which your knowledge base for those conclusions does not give you absolute certainty for those conclusions. And the best you can do is to say, this is probably the right answer. Don't answer this question, but or you don't have to if you don't want to, but you know, if we do this, 700 billion dollar bailout program that is being talked about in Washington today, will that solve our avert an economic crisis in this country? Will that be good enough? Well, it's hard to say. Some people think this will do the trick, or at least it's absolutely necessary and will stave off disaster. Others are warning that it's not going to really solve anything. We can find ourselves in even more serious trouble. Is there anybody who can say, with all that is involved in assessing a question like that, they are absolutely certain of what needs to be done and how much it's going to cost and et cetera? Probably not. There I go again. Probably. We look at the arguments, we look at the evidence that people present for their particular assessment of these things, we look at the rationale for doing this, we look at the explanation for the estimates that people give as to how much it's going to cost, and we end up deciding that, well, okay, probably this is the right way to go, or probably it's not going to work. On a much more simple or mundane level, an evidentialist will point out to you, you know, every time you cross a street, you make a probability assessment. You say, I think my eyesight is good enough that I can look both ways and determine that I am not in danger of being hit by a truck if I cross the street. Now, you might see a truck half a mile off and think you've got plenty of time to cross the street. You might not see any truck or car at all and assess that your eyesight is reliable enough that you are confident that there is nothing to be afraid of, and so you cross the street. But it is possible that that truck is closer than you thought, or moving faster than you thought, or that your eyesight is failing you and you don't realize it. And so the evidentialist points out, as simple and mundane a decision as to whether or not to cross the street is always based on probabilities. You're not absolutely certain that you're going to cross the street safely, but that doesn't stop you, hopefully, from crossing the street. If it did, you know, the economy would really come to a screeching halt now, wouldn't it? Because we would all be stuck immobile where we sit for fear of getting hit by something. No, we look both ways, hopefully, and we decide, all right, looks like it's okay to go, probably going to be all right, and we go. Well, the evidentialist says all of life is like that. Joseph Butler says probability is the very guide of life. Everything is like that. All decisions that you make in life are like that. You can't avoid it. So rather than trying to avoid reaching conclusions based on that kind of thinking, based on probability, embrace it, accept it, get used to it, and let's look at the evidence for Christianity as if it were any other question. And this is a crucial qualification here. As if it were any other question, let's look at the evidence. Let's try to be impartial. Evidentialists aren't naive. They admit that it's not easy to be impartial and that nobody's perfectly impartial, but let's do everything we can to minimize bias. Let's look at the evidence. Let's get as much evidence on the table as we can, and let's test the various explanations to see which one is the best explanation for the evidence, which conclusion best matches the evidence. I've already used several buzzwords and important phrases and key expressions that are used in evidential apologetics here. And I'm trying to give you the general picture here, the general approach. And Butler's statement that probability is the very guide of life is a quintessential statement of the assumption or presupposition about how we decide anything is true that represents a radical shift from the approach that was taken classically in Christian apologetics, which was primarily deductive, in which the conclusions were regarded as absolutely certain if your premises were true. There could be no room for doubt. A leads to B, B leads to C, with inexorable logic. Instead of that, we get all of our data points. We get A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, and we put them all together and we try to come up with a conclusion. And the conclusion is more or less adequate, more or less successful in correlating these data points, and we come to a conclusion. And the conclusion isn't absolutely certain, but it's the best we can do, and we can have varying degrees of confidence in this conclusion. Now, I want to take the rest of my time here in introducing the idea of evidential apologetics to highlight some distinct but not entirely separate models of evidential apologetics. And these will probably be familiar to you, at least to some extent. One model that deserves to be given special attention can be described as the legal model of apologetics. The legal model of apologetics is a form of evidentialism that says the way you show that Christianity is true is basically by holding court. You imagine that you're in a courtroom, and your responsibility is to sift the evidence, is to weigh the evidence the way a jury would in a courtroom, listen to the arguments on both sides, look at all the evidence that's presented by the prosecution and the defense, And following the rules of legal inquiry, legal scholarship, legal discovery, in a way mimicking what lawyers do in a court and what the jury has to do with what the lawyers present, you're going to weigh the cases that are presented by the opposing sides and seek to reach a conclusion. Now, this legal approach to apologetics has a long and venerable history. As far back as the early 1700s, even before Joseph Butler's Analogy of Religion, there were Christian apologists using a legal model for defending Christianity. Thomas Sherlock wrote a book in 1729 called The Trial of the Witnesses of the Resurrection of Jesus. Sherlock argued that the resurrection was an historical event, and he argued this as if he were putting the whole question of the resurrection on trial and deciding if an impartial jury would find in favor of the resurrection. A variety of Christian apologists since Sherlock have done the same thing with the Gospels or with the New Testament in an attempt to establish whether the resurrection really happened or not. In the 19th century, the most famous apologist to do this was Simon Greenleaf. Simon Greenleaf wrote a book called The Testimony of the Evangelists that has been reprinted periodically over the last 125, 135 years. Greenleaf was a Harvard professor of legal evidences. Imagine a Harvard professor doing this today. I mean, he would be out on his ear, wouldn't he? very likely. But in 1874, Greenleaf wrote a book called The Testimony of the Evangelists, in which he argued that applying legal evidences, the legal reasoning to the Gospels, one could show that they were reliable sources of information and that the resurrection of Jesus Christ was an historical event. So you have Sherlock in the 18th century doing this. You've got Greenleaf in the late 19th century doing this. The quintessential example of an evidentialist using this legal approach in the 20th century and into the 21st century is John Warwick Montgomery. And I'm going to write his name out here. John Warwick Montgomery founded a school called Simon Greenleaf School of Law, later known as Simon Greenleaf University. And you can immediately see the connection there with the famous 19th century Christian apologist and legal scholar Simon Greenleaf. Montgomery saw Greenleaf as a hero of apologists, the apologist's apologist, and sought to extend and to develop and to champion Greenleaf's method for Christian apologetics. Montgomery has been one of the most prolific apologists of the last 35, 40 years, 50 years, getting close to now, I think. And he is to evidentialism what Norman Geisler is to classical apologetics, to put it mildly, maybe more so. Through Simon Greenleaf University and through his books and tapes, he put out a cassette tape series back in the 70s at least, Montgomery has taught numerous Christian apologists how to do their trade. Numerous Christian apologists got their basic training in apologetics from Montgomery, who is, I think this is fair to say, whether you agree with him or not, whether you even like him or not, Montgomery is one of the smartest Christian scholars that we've had in the past 50 years. I'm sure he'd be happy to hear me say that. Montgomery is a brilliant man, extremely knowledgeable on a wide variety of subjects. And this is exactly the kind of thing you need to do, if you want to be a great Christian apologist. From an evidential perspective, you want to know as much as you can about as many things as you can, because the whole point of evidentialism is to bring together evidences from every place you can find it. And Montgomery did that. Montgomery appealed to a wide variety of evidences. However, his primary interest in apologetics was in what we would call historical apologetics. That is, Montgomery was focused primarily on presenting an historical case for Christianity that was focused, centered, fixated, really, on the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It would not be an exaggeration to say that Montgomery's argument for Christianity goes something like this. And this is oversimplifying, but it's not really inaccurate at all. His argument really can be boiled down to this: Jesus rose from the dead, therefore God exists. That is to say, Montgomery argues that a patient, careful, even-handed application of historical methodology using legal standards of evidence to the documents that we have pertaining to what happened to Jesus after he died will demonstrate that, in fact, Jesus certainly did die, he was buried, and he rose bodily from the grave and appeared to several people. Montgomery argues that one can reach this conclusion simply by assessing the evidence that we have in the documents without in any way presupposing, assuming, or arguing first that God exists. One does not need to bring God into the question. One simply looks at the evidence, finds that the evidence supports the conclusion that Jesus rose from the dead. Then Montgomery says, let's look at this surprising finding in its historical context. How do we explain that Jesus rose from the dead? Is it some kind of anomalous freak of nature? No. Jesus' whole life really makes sense in light of the resurrection as someone who purported to be the Son of God, as someone who purported to have been sent by God to bring us salvation and bring us back to a knowledge of God. And so Montgomery concludes that once you've established historically, evidentially, that Jesus rose from the dead, and you look at this event in its historical context, you find that, in fact, Jesus' resurrection is a proof, is a strong, compelling evidence that that God exists. Now, let's compare that with Norman Geisler. Geisler's argument goes like this: God exists, and of course that's based on arguments that he presents, such as the cosmological argument. That would be his primary argument. We can show that God exists. Having established first that God exists, we look at the evidence of what happened to Jesus, and we can see, within a theistic worldview context, that the best explanation for the evidence is that Jesus rose from the dead. But Geisler would insist you have to first show that theism is the best worldview. If you don't, the apparent evidence for the resurrection will have to be discarded as anomalous, as freakish, as, well, we don't really know what happened, but obviously dead people don't rise from the dead. Montgomery, on the other hand, says, no, you don't have to bring God into it first. You can come at it by saying, I don't know if God exists or not, but let's see what happened to Jesus. Oh my goodness, he rose from the dead. Jesus claimed to be a representative of God. He claimed to speak for God. His resurrection would certainly seem to validate that claim. Looks like God exists. And so he reasons really in almost the reverse of what Geisler would say, where you first show that God exists, then you can show that Jesus rose from the dead. Montgomery reverses that and says, first you show that Jesus rose from the dead, and then you can conclude that God exists. So we've got two very different arguments here, don't we? We've got two very different approaches to Christian apologetics. They're both concluding that that God exists. They're both concluding that Christianity is true. They don't disagree theologically, at least on anything really major or significant theologically. They're not seeing each other as a heretic or anything, but gee, it's interesting they have such very different approaches to defending Christianity. Now that is what that illustrates the legal evidences approach. The legal evidences approach really focuses on historical questions because, of course, that's what lawyers do. That's what you do in a court of law. You ask what happened to the body. How did this person die? If he was killed, who killed him? These are the kinds of questions that you ask if you are in a court of law. You're asking questions about what happened in the past. Well, that's history. And so naturally, those who advocate a legal evidential type approach to Christian apologetics, like Montgomery, are going to be especially keen on doing historical apologetics. And if you're going to do historical apologetics as a Christian, the most natural place that you would look to apply this method is in the most stupendous and most crucial historical claim that Christianity makes, which is the resurrection of Jesus. And so Montgomery and others who advocate this approach focus a great deal of their efforts, let's put it that way, on defending the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Now, another approach to apologetics in the evidentialist tradition is another variety of historical apologetics it doesn't disagree with the legal evidences model, but it approaches it in a different way. And this approach to apologetics, this particular form of evidential apologetics, might be best associated with Gary Habermas. Gary Habermas, who teaches at Liberty University, and is certainly one of the most popular Christian apologists today, and by the way, is something of a friend of mine. I've gotten to know Gary over the last few years, and Gary he's a great guy. He's a fun guy to be around, a nice guy. Gary is probably the leading Christian apologist actively working today, writing books and speaking and so forth on the subject of the resurrection. Even more so than Montgomery, who's a little less visible in Christian apologetics today, and Habermas has written very influential books specifically on the resurrection of Jesus. And again, not radically different in his approach than Montgomery, as compared to Montgomery, but different in that he has a specific technique, you might almost call it, or a specific method that is known as the minimal facts method. This is a very important term, and it really epitomizes Habermas's approach to defending the resurrection. Now, like Montgomery, but maybe even more so, Habermas focuses on the evidence for the resurrection in almost all of his work. It really is his life work. He has talked about other things and written on other things, but this is number one by far. And what Habermas does is something that is a particular strategy. You really could describe it more as an apologetic strategy than a specific or different method than the one that Montgomery advocates. The minimal facts approach goes like this. Rather than bringing forward every possible bit of evidence for the resurrection, which would be more of the kind of approach that Montgomery would take, perhaps, what Habermas does is, he says, let's boil down our evidences for the resurrection to those few minimal facts that almost all scholars would have to concede, that even skeptics and liberals and atheists and, you know, Buddhists and whoever else might be examining the historical evidence have admitted, yeah, I have to admit that part of it's true. Now, Habermas and others who have taken the same approach, that use the same strategy, have compiled somewhat varying lists over the years of what these minimal facts are. But here are the typical items that make the list of the minimal facts. That Jesus died on a Roman cross. That the disciples of Jesus had experiences that they believed were appearances of the risen Jesus. That their lives were dramatically transformed from scared little rabbits to courageous, fearless apostles prepared to lay down their lives for the gospel, and that Saul of Tarsus, a Pharisee, rabbi, opponent of Christianity, had his life completely turned around by an experience that he also thought was the appearance of the risen Christ to him. Sometimes Habermas and other minimal facts apologists have suggested that the empty tomb is one of these minimal facts. Right now, I would say the trend has been away from including that as one of the minimal facts, but sometimes that has been included. So what Habermas does in this minimal facts approach is to start with these bare bones facts that he says, you know, he's researched all of the writings of the various scholars who have written, you know, whatever university or college they might be associated with or whatever publishing house might be publishing them. He's surveyed all of the academic literature and this, you know, English, German, French, and this is what virtually all or the vast preponderance of scholars, the vast majority of scholars agree upon, that Jesus died on the cross and that perhaps that he was buried, certainly that he died, though, that people saw him alive, that their lives were changed, Saul of Tarsus was changed from an enemy of Christianity to an advocate, and so he will then reason from these conclusions, these facts, which are the minimal list of facts that could be adduced in support of the resurrection. And then he will reason that the resurrection of Jesus is the best explanation for these facts. Now, the style of reasoning here is known by a somewhat technical phrase as the inference to the best explanation. An inference to the best explanation is you start with the facts that pretty much everybody has to admit, and you look at those facts, you ask, what are the possible explanations that we could come up with for these facts? And you list all the possible explanations. And whichever one of those explanations is the best explanation wins. And next time we're going to talk about what some of the criteria might be that people would use to decide what's the best explanation, but this is the style of reasoning. Notice that this is an inference to the best explanation, not the only possible explanation. Again, evidentialists are not trying to reach a rationally undeniable, incorrigibly certain conclusion. They're admitting that there are other possible explanations for the evidence, but they will argue that the resurrection is the best explanation for the evidence. Now, very briefly, and I'm not going to elaborate on this model or strategy of evidentialism because I don't have time to do that, but very briefly, the third one would be a scientific model of apologetics in which the apologist seeks to mimic or copy the argumentative strategies used in science in order to defend Christianity, and in fact may actually attempt to use scientific information, scientific analyses, scientific evidences drawn from the natural sciences, from the biological sciences and the astronomy and geology and physics and chemistry and so forth, in order to present a case for the existence of God, and will also attempt to defend other Christian beliefs, even perhaps including the resurrection, by using arguments that would employ the same kinds of reasoning strategies that one uses in science. That is, we're going to develop a theory, we're going to test that theory, we're going to put a hypothesis to the test, we're going to look to see if it's if it has any kind of predictive power, we're going to see if it is a theory that really works well to explain a wide variety of evidence and so forth. So they're going to argue as if they were doing science. All right, so, again, I apologize that we're not going to elaborate on that, but I'm going to talk more about that next time. But as you can see, these are all variations on a theme in evidential apologetics, which is we're going to argue that Christianity is probably true based on the evidence that we have. We will admit that it's not the only possible explanation of the evidence, but it's the best explanation, or it's the most cogent explanation, or it's the most probable explanation. And that's really all one can ask for in the real world. If all you're dealing with is mathematical equations, geometric expressions, philosophical speculative hypotheses or theories that one is spinning out philosophically out of your own mind, then the evidentialist says you can have certainty in those areas. But once you get down to real hard facts, did God create the world? Did God raise Jesus from the dead? You're asking questions about empirical reality. We do not have absolute certainty about any such thing. Therefore, the best we can do is probability. The best we can do is the best explanation, not necessarily the only logically possible explanation. All right, so now at this point here, I'm simply trying to explain the what's distinctive about the evidentialist approach, and especially comparing it and contrasting it with the classical approach. We are by no means done here. Next week we're going to talk more about evidentialism. We're going to elaborate on some of these things in more depth. And then in subsequent weeks we're going to look at even some other approaches to apologetics that are neither the classical nor the evidentialist approach. And toward the end of our series of classes, we will then get into some of the whys and wherefores and the strengths and weaknesses of these different approaches, and you will have plenty of opportunities to sort of get into a discussion about maybe which one you think is the best approach and why, or what you like about this approach or that approach. So all that's coming, but before we you know, land on one and say, this is the right one, we're going to use this, and only this. I think it's appropriate to compare the methods, get to know them from the inside, get to understand why people like these methods, why they've historically developed them, and then you can have an appreciation for them as a basis for deciding what use of them you're going to make. And we will get into presuppositional apologetics in 2 weeks, actually, because we're going to spend more time on evidentialism next week. All right, now, went a little bit long here, but there's a lot to cover, obviously, and maybe I even cut into a little bit into what I would have normally presented next week, but I want to go ahead and, in the time that we have left here, open it up for your comments and your questions. If you'd like to use the microphone, indicate that you'd like to do that, and I will yield the microphone. Hopefully, we won't have anybody causing trouble, which we did have that last week. That was a little bit amusing. But if you'd like to type out your question, you can do that, and I'll read that and respond to that. So either way, and that's fine, Carrie, don't worry about that. But anyway, however you'd like to present your your question or your comment. And again, you can make a comment. You don't have to just ask a question. But if you do have any questions or things that you'd like to maybe ask about or explore a little bit, then I want to give you guys some time to do that. And Daniel, I will yield the microphone to you and let you ask your question. Oh, sorry to hear that your microphone isn't working, Daniel. If you want to type your question out, I will try to repeat that for the recording and then answer it. Somebody asks, do many apologists use more than one apologetic method or a combination? And the answer to that question is most definitely. There are, first of all, as I mentioned last week, when classical apologists do apologetics, the step one, arguing for theism, is of course a standard classical apologetic type argument. When they get to step two, defending Christianity as the true form of theism, their arguments are very, very similar, in some cases might as well be identical to those of evidentialists. William Lane Craig is an example of somebody who does this. Now, Craig is a classical apologist and not technically an evidentialist, according to his own explanation, but he certainly sounds like an evidentialist when he's talking about the resurrection. And the reason why he can do that is because he has, first of all, somewhat flexible understanding of what classical apologetics requires, but secondly, because when you are a classical apologist, you can go straight to, you can talk about the evidence for the resurrection from within the context of a theistic worldview, and that's fine. So, I mean, in fact, Craig actually borrows not only from evidentialists in terms of his method, but he also borrows from Reformed apologists, and we'll talk about their approach, which again, William Lane Craig take some of that here and there, and other apologists do the same thing. Evidentialists, of some varieties of evidentialists, because they like to bring in evidences from everywhere they can find it, they will use classical arguments, they will use presuppositional arguments, they will use historical or legal arguments, they'll use any kind of argument that they can find that seems to work, and they don't care about sticking to one method, because as far as they're concerned, all the arguments have some value, and let's get them all on the table. There are also apologists who have deliberately and consciously sought to bring together some of these approaches, and we're going to talk about them toward the end of this course. These would be people, for example, like Francis Schaeffer, who was one of the most popular apologists of the 20th century, and Edward John Carnell, probably one of the first to go about systematically trying to find a way to bring these together, and other apologists have sought to do the same thing. So, yes, there are apologists who try to combine them in some way or try to integrate them in some way. And we're going to be talking about integrative approaches and what those have looked like historically, and you know whether those are the right approach or not, way to do it, whether they are different approaches or not. So we'll try to get into all that toward the end of the course. Are there any other questions? Want to make sure you get a chance to, or just observations or comments that came to your mind as we're going through this, that's fine too. You asked how many here have become Christians via apologetic argument. I would like to say that apologetic argument certainly helped me. Yes, I'd be interested to know the other people who are here as students, if apologetics helped them. I would like to speak up and say that they helped me come to Christianity and accept Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. That having some kind of reasoned basis for faith was important to me, and I know other people that it was important to them as well. Carol wants to know which method helped me, I guess, and maybe some others here as well. And you know, I think the Christians that I talked to, I'm not sure that I could pinpoint what their method was. It would have had to have been either classical or evidential. But as we have pointed out, these are actually overlapping in some ways, and so difficult to sort out which would be which. I would say that classical apologists and evidentialists were important in my early education, if you will, as an apologist. In my early years in reading Christian apologetics, I read C.S. Lewis, who I would classify as a classical apologist. Not everyone would agree with that classification, but I that's how I would classify him. But I ended up reading in a lot of other Christian apologists, including Montgomery and others who were evidentialists. And so it really was a long time before I understood that there was any kind of a difference between these two approaches. And there are people today who are active in apologetics who would say, you know, I don't know that I could pick one or the other. They haven't really thought about it very much. But there is a difference that's worth noting, and historically there's a reason for it, and that is the development of modern science and modern academia, and the way that that has changed our view of knowledge and of how the acquisition of knowledge. And it's important to understand that if we're to understand why we have these different approaches. Let me say that I appreciate those of you who have been coming here week after week to spend this hour and a half with me to talk about apologetics and listen to me go on about these different apologists and their approaches. I hope that you're finding this helpful. It's a lot to absorb, and again, we're trying to build up a picture here historically and even culturally to understand why it is that we have so many different kinds of approaches to apologetics. And I would just emphasize that my interest here is primarily in introducing them to you and giving them some context so that you can appreciate what they have been offering and what they have to say. Rather than coming here as an advocate for one and seeking to, you know, sort of polemicize for my approach and against any others. I have my opinions about these things, but I hope that those will take a back seat to simply being descriptive and helping to clarify what these different approaches have in common as well as where they are different. Let me address Daniel's question now. He asks, because of Muslim extremists and their willingness to die for their beliefs, do you think it undermines the argument for the resurrection that people make when they say that the fact that disciples changed their lives and were willing to die for their beliefs proves that the resurrection is the best possibility or the best explanation for the evidence? And The answer to that is no, I don't think it undermines the argument, although the argument might need to be fine-tuned so as to clarify why Muslims being willing to die for their faith does not prove that that their belief is true. The disciples, when Muslims die for their beliefs, they are not dying for something that they know is false. When a Muslim terrorist commits suicide or engages in a terrorist act in against perceived enemies of Islam, the Muslim is doing this because he sincerely believes that by dying for his faith in Allah and in Muhammad, his messenger, that he will be guaranteed life in paradise. Now, we who are not Muslims think the Muslim is wrong about this, but the Muslim certainly is sincere. He sincerely believes that he will get to paradise for this. Now, what does that prove? Well, it only proves that he sincerely believes that there is a paradise and that he'll get there, but he believes this because it was taught to him as part of the religion of Islam, and he accepts the religion of Islam for some other reason that his willingness to die does not really explain or really have any direct connection to. Now, compare that with the willingness of the apostles of Jesus Christ to die for their confession. We really need to be more specific here. It isn't merely that the apostles were willing to die for their faith. Lots of people are willing to die for what they believe. The apostles were willing to die for their belief that they personally had seen Jesus alive from the dead. Now, either they sincerely believed that, or they did not. It's a little hard to explain why apostles would go through life dirt poor, beaten up every town they came into, you know, like Paul had happened to Paul. Seemed like every other town anyway he'd come to, he'd get beaten up or put in jail or, you know, something, run out of town on a rail, as they say. Why would an apostle like Paul go through all that? He's not getting anything material out of it. He's not getting rich. He's not getting famous. Really, almost nobody heard of Paul until, you know, 100, 200 years after he died. He wasn't famous in his own day. He didn't have any power. He didn't have, you know, the things that men usually are looking for if they're selfish. He didn't have women. He didn't have money. He didn't have power. He didn't have any of that stuff. He's going around getting beaten up and thrown in jail and suffering all kinds of things for his testimony that he had seen Jesus alive from the dead. Now, why does a guy do that? Well, he does it because he sincerely believes that Jesus appeared to him. All right, so what are we trying to establish when we point out that they were willing to die for what they believed? We're pointing out that their testimony was sincere. This is not a direct one-step argument that Jesus rose from the dead, but it gets us a step closer because it establishes that these witnesses are telling the truth as they saw it. These people sincerely believed that they saw Jesus risen from the dead after he had been killed and buried. Now, that is an historical fact. And I'm going to put it that way because the vast majority of biblical scholars, Jewish, liberal Christian, radical skeptic, you know, Paula Fredrickson, Marcus Borg, you know, all these people admit that the disciples sincerely believed that they had seen the risen Jesus. Paula Fredrickson, who's Jewish, says she doesn't know what really happened. She's not saying it was really Jesus, but She is saying they sincerely believed they had seen the risen Jesus. Now, that's an historical fact. It's one of the facts that you put in that little pile of minimal facts that Gary Habermas talks about. And you have to explain it. And then you look, the evidentialist will say, you look at the hypotheses that are offered to explain these experiences of the disciples. And some of them will possibly work, and some of them are not even possible, and some of them are a little bit better than others, and one of them, according to the evidentialist, stands way above the others in plausibility based on the information that we have, and that is that Jesus actually had risen from the dead. You know, the alternatives are all poor explanations. It was an hallucination. It was a duplicate, a double, an identical twin. You know, these are all poor explanations that they're not very good. And we're going to talk more about this next week. But the point here is that the willingness of the apostles to die. Some of them did die for their faith. Some of them didn't. But the willingness of the apostles to die for their faith demonstrates that they were not con artists, they were not charlatans, they were not frauds, purporting that Jesus had appeared to them when they knew darn well he had not. These people sincerely believed that they had encounters with the risen Jesus. That needs to be explained. You see, the Muslim can be as sincere as they want, but they don't have any facts about Muhammad, for example, that they can personally attest to. The Muslim who's willing to commit suicide for his faith, or who's willing to blow up other people and himself in the process for his religion, cannot tell you from any personal experience anything that happened to Muhammad. He doesn't know, he wasn't there. The fact that I might sincerely be willing to die for my faith does not in any way prove that Jesus rose from the dead, because I wasn't there. I don't have any personal physical eyewitness testimony to offer you in this regard. But Paul did. Peter did. James did. John did. Mary Magdalene did. And so that's the difference in the argument. By the way, Joseph Smith was not, quote-unquote, willing to die for what he believed. Joseph Smith pulled out a gun and tried to shoot his way out of his predicament before he got shot to death in that jail in Carthage in 1844. There were some Mormons, including Joseph Smith, who died for their faith, but you could put it that way, but they didn't go willingly. They didn't go like sheep to the slaughter. They didn't go like the suffering servant. And that particular representation is really a mythology that has, been a mythological way of telling the story of early Mormonism that Mormons use as a kind of an apologetic stratagem, but it's not historically accurate. Were the early Mormons sincere? Many of them probably were. Were they all sincere? I don't know. But the fact that Joseph Smith got killed doesn't prove that he was sincere. That's just, I'm sorry, it's not a good argument. I think that's probably all the time that we have today. Next week we're going to elaborate in more depth on certain aspects of evidentialism. We're going to go into some of the arguments in more depth. We're going to look at the evidence for the resurrection in an evidentialist fashion. We're going to talk about some of the questions that come up about the evidentialist approach and how an evidentialist handles those problems in apologetic argumentation. We're also going to talk about scientific apologetics and explore how evidentialists do science and their understanding of the way science works and how science can be an ally in Christian apologetics, and compare that with the classical approach and try to get some insights there as to, again, what is distinctive about the evidentialist approach. And then after we finish with evidentialism in subsequent weeks, we're going to talk about Reformed apologetics, which includes the presuppositionalism of Cornelius Van Til, also Gordon Clark. We're going to talk about the new Reformed epistemology approach of Alvin Plantinga and people like that. And then we're going to talk a little bit about Fideism. And if you don't know what that is, wait till we get to that. That'll be fun. And then we're going to finish up our discussion of apologetic methods by looking at some people that tried to bring together various approaches into some kind of synthesized or integrated holistic approach, and discuss some of the pros and cons of going about it that way. Thank you very much for your attention. Thanks for some very good questions there at the end. Look forward to spending more time with you next week.